Okay, let's start. It's a real privilege to do this. I've never introduced Subhuti. As long as I've been practicing Chiratna, which is 25 years or so, Subhuti has been giving energetically, actively, constantly, it feels like, to the Sangha. And actually, he's been doing that 40 or 50 years. I couldn't tell you the exact number. 55 years. I mean, there is this
thing. He was very young when I started, yeah.
Yes, you started as a toddler, which is wonderful. There is this saying, isn't there, that you know somebody by their actions. And in fact, the Buddha himself, when he was asked, how do you know the depth of someone's practice? He said, well, you have to observe them quite closely for a long time. Now, I've not been able to observe Subhuti closely. We haven't lived together, but I have at a distance, as many of you have been able to observe his actions and how he has acted as a really faithful disciple of Bhante, perhaps one of the most active and faithful disciples of Sangharakshita. I mean, I'll mention some of the things, but I mean, he oversaw the development of the London Buddhist Center, still our biggest Buddhist center, Kukkiloka Men's Retreat Center, the men's ordination process at Padmaloka. He's been very active in the ordination process in India for many, many years. He's written many books. I mean, where am I going to stop with it? Many important papers, including those 7 papers that we probably most of us have studied that came out over the last, I don't know how many years, 5 years or so of Bhante's life. So just really, really important member of our order. And I'm delighted to be introducing Subhuti today. For those of you who weren't here earlier, Surya Gupta won't be joining us. She also has fallen ill with COVID, not seriously in the way that unfortunately Alexandra has. She's at home, but she's not well enough to speak. So she sends her apologies. So Subhuti is going to have longer to speak. He's going to have 40 minutes, whatever he needs to talk to us today. And then there will be the opportunity for questions. So again, it's a rare thing to have a chance to ask Subhuti questions. And that's what we mean by it being a seminar. So as you're listening to this talk, if there's anything you think, oh, I'd like to know more about that, or I've got a question about that, there'll be the chance at the end of his talk. His talk is, as this whole day is on the theme of what the world needs now. He's going to particularly focus on the gifts that Tri Ratna offers in terms of an international community and a vision of truth. So thank you very much. Over to you, Subhuti.
Thank you very much, Amalavadra. Priya Bhayo Bheno, Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim. And good evening, good morning, good afternoon, who knows, good night to everybody. Mis amigos en Mexico, nos veremos muy pronto. In 2 semanas solo. I'm very sad indeed that I'm not doing this with Surya Gupta. I was quite interested in how that would work. I mean, I knew it would be positive, but we've got different styles, different approaches. And I thought that might make a very interesting, what in Indian music is called jugalbandi, when two instruments sort of play off each other. But that's sadly not to be. It's, I'm afraid, very much your loss. I'll do my best to fill her shoes as well as my own. So I want to start by telling you something that's happened to me quite recently that has moved me very much indeed. It's about 6 weeks ago, I got an email from Trinidad. I know very little about Trinidad, although oddly, I'd had a few other connections from Trinidad quite recently before that. But I had an email that was indirectly from a 90-year-old man called Dr. Hugh Skinner, who is a fascinating character. He's Trinidadian and an author, poet, and novelist, a polemicist. He's got a big volume of very, very interesting articles on political and social questions. He's an academic, or been an academic. He's been a journalist. He's traveled the world. A really very interesting man indeed. And he'd found, quite by chance, a copy of a book that I wrote 40 years ago called Buddhism for Today: A Portrait of a New Buddhist Movement. When I read it now, I find I'm both embarrassed by its naivety and thrilled by its inspirational tone. I think actually we need a new version of it, if not by me, then by somebody else. But he'd read it, or rather he'd just found it on his shelves. He doesn't quite know how he got it. On the front, it was inscribed Ratnadakini. She doesn't know how it got to him. He opened it at random and found there a poem by Bhante on the wind horse, which I think most people will know. For those who don't, it's a key Buddhist symbol that is important for us in Tri Ratna. And he was amazed, because 2 days before that, he'd written a poem about a horse charging across the sky, sparks flying from its heels, and flames coming from its nostrils. So on the strength of that, he read the whole book. He said he wasn't really much inclined to religion, and if anything, was somewhat anti-religious. in its normal form, as it were. But he read the whole book, and at the end of it, he just wanted to get in contact with me as quickly as he could to ask for ordination. That's quite something in it. You can imagine what it is for me, you know, that 40 years ago I wrote something, published something, that has that resonance for somebody in another part of the world, which I've never visited, don't know much about. It's very near Venezuela, of course. But yes, he wants to be ordained. So I felt some satisfaction with my life in that way. Not only that, he wants us to start a center in Trinidad as soon as possible. He's 90 and he doesn't think he's got much time. So he wants us to get out there and get that center going as quickly as possible. Now, I take this all very, very seriously. There's something about it, about the tone of it and the impression I get of him, that I take him absolutely seriously. And I certainly intend myself, if I can, to get out to Trinidad in August, September, of course, nowhere near the beaches, and just to make contact with him and to, well, see what can be done. But I'm very much hoping an Indian friend of mine, he's showing interest in going out, and if he can raise the funds and so forth, he'll try and go out before me and look into things, because something like a third of the population of Trinidad is of Indian origin. And Hugh himself is partly from Indian origin. So anybody out there with any Trinidadian connections, whether you are from Trinidad or you know people from Trinidad, please let me know, and let's start the Hugh Skinner Center in Port of Spain or somewhere appropriate in Trinidad. Anyway, I wanted just to communicate that to you, because it's such a wonderful story and so inspiring. What I wanted to communicate to you was what he'd picked up on in that naive book of so long ago. He'd obviously got that vision of existence from Bhante that I describe rather briefly in the opening chapters of the book. I describe the general account that we usually have of the wheel, the spiral, and the mandala, gave a kind of brief survey of the vision of existence that is the inspiration for our movement. Of course, the vision itself is not in the words or the symbols, it's in the actual seeing, but the words express that vision. So that had clearly clicked with him. He's been a man who's had an inquiring, he's been on a quest all his life, and has investigated in so many areas of culture and life, thought deeply. And he'd obviously, in that account that I gave, found something that he could respond to absolutely immediately. Do you remember that feeling yourself? I remember it when I first came across Bhante teaching. I just immediately thought, that's what I think. That's what I see. But I could never have expressed it for myself. But in Bhante's expression of it, not just in the words, but in the manner of his expression, I immediately knew this is the vision that I wanted to live by. So I imagine something like that happened for Dr. Hugh Skinner. But then he seemed to have responded very strongly to the idea of the movement as socially transformative. He'd responded very strongly to the vision of an alternative society, the new society. And he believed that his own island, his own beloved island, needed such a transformation, and that our movement, he now calls it our movement, should be there to take this forward, because he feels that the pressure of modern commercialism, environmental degradation, and so forth is really spoiling such a beautiful tropical paradise. So he's responded very strongly to that, which is a component of my book. But then he'd responded very strongly to the ideal of community, and of friendship, of spiritual friendship, of Kalyanamitrata. And he wrote saying that he felt a very deep connection with me, just as soon as he read that book, a very strong spiritual connection. He says he wants to see me in the flesh so he can give me a big hug, but that in a way it's not necessary because the spiritual connection is already there. And I feel that myself. Now, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that extraordinary? Somebody had caught the flavor of our Sri Ratna over, you know, 40 years, over so many miles, and such big barriers of culture and difference and so forth. He picked it up, and in a way that apparently is characteristic of Trinidadians, another Trinidadian told me, just signed up for it. And I take him absolutely seriously. If it was in my power, I'd just take my kesar and put it round his neck. But nowadays, things are more complicated than that. Bante used to travel with a kesar in his bag and claim that he would put it round the neck of anybody he thought was ready, regardless of whether they'd been through the ordination process and so forth. But those days have gone. Anyway, yes, that vision that we have, that vision of the nature of existence, as Bante has presented the Buddha's vision to us, touched him. That vision of the power of the Dhamma to transform society had touched him. And especially the immediate flavor of Kalyanamitrata had reached him. And I'm encouraging many people to give him a ring and have a chat with him. Ratnadakini's already phoned him, and he's so grateful to her for somehow that book getting to him. But I'm hoping that we'll really honor him in this sort of way. Anyway, I better move on because I need to talk a little bit more. Although in a way, I think I've said all I really want to say. In the person of Dr. Hugh Skinner, we've heard what the world needs now. He saw what the world needs now from his long, long experience as a deeply, widely read man. He's a real polymath. The bits of writing he sent to me are just full of so many references. He feels a very strong need of the world in crisis. No need to multiply examples of that crisis. They're right in front of us at the moment, although they're always there. What the world needs now is that vision of existence. And he felt it, he saw it, and so on. So yes, let me just briefly say what you all already know, just to briefly recapitulate for you what that vision of existence is. I know in the title it's called a vision of truth, but Bante's original phrase was a vision of existence, which I think is slightly better, if you see what I mean. Truth is not an object, as it were, but it's a way of perceiving reality, a vision of reality. It's a vision that is a direct spiritual insight, not a set of dogmas or theories. It's a direct intuition, to put it that way. It's a direct intuition of what makes for suffering in this world. In other words, an insight into the wheel. It's an insight into the freedom from suffering that comes from Buddhahood. In other words, a vision of the mandala. And it's a vision of how we get from the suffering to the state of freedom. That is the path. That is the vision that Bante has set out for us with such astounding clarity and in such relevant terms that communicates so directly to us. Of course, it's fundamentally the vision of the Buddha, but Bante has expressed it in his own particular way, in a way that's especially powerful based upon his recognition of the central importance of Pratityasamutpada. So that's what's needed. The world needs a new view, a new vision, because everybody has a view. First chapter of my second book, A Buddhist Vision, starts with that. Everyone has a view. We've all got a way of understanding reality, a way of understanding life. And that way of understanding things, it's not necessarily thought and expressed. It's not philosophical. It's sort of assumed. It's fundamental. Very often, we're not able to articulate it. And it may even be quite contradictory. But underlying everything we do, everything we say, is a view, a perspective. It can be good, it can be bad. Mr. Putin is in Russia because of a view. Those Russian soldiers who are there without really knowing where they are there because of views. Let's not multiply examples. We're here, you and I, brothers and sisters, are here because of a view, because of an understanding, an approach, an attitude, a fundamental perspective that leads us to spend a Saturday morning, afternoon, or evening in this particular way, in rejoicing in the foundation of our wonderful Tri Ratna community. So we need a view that is truly satisfying, that answers all our questions, that explains life to us, that gives our lives meaning, and is a guide to our actions, that provides a basis of morality to guide our lives, so we know what is skillful, what is unskillful. That is what the world needs. If it doesn't have it, it's simply an arena of competing views, clashing views. Eventually, views, unless they're transcended in vision, come into conflict because they're all based on self-clinging. All views ultimately have their roots in our attachment to ourselves. So we need a vision that takes us beyond that. That's what is going to save the world. And it's our job in Tri Ratna to promote that vision of existence as widely as we possibly can, so that as many people as possible can share that perspective. Of course, we share it with other Buddhists, and we work alongside them to promote it. But Bhante has given us a uniquely clear presentation of it, which is very down to earth and very practical. So that's our job. We need to communicate that much more vigorously. That vision is also the basis for a real human society, a truly human society, because human society is brought together ultimately by views. And probably one of the issues that we have in society today is that there are many competing views. Politics, of course, is the expression of that, but something more fundamental in social life, competing views that lead to so much conflict, so much misery. We see it in the highly polarized political situation that we have in so many countries today. We see it in the racial tensions that there are, in all sorts of other tensions, in caste tensions, and so on. So we need a vision that can provide a truly human society, because we don't live in isolation. We don't just live alone. We don't even follow the path alone. We can't follow the path alone because we do not exist alone. There is no I separate from other people. I is simply the intersection of all my relationships, if you see what I mean. I exist at the point where all my individual relationships cross over. There's not a me separate from that. I am the intersection of all those relationships, human relationships that I have. I don't exist independently. I experienced this very, very strongly on a solitary retreat recently. I did a quite long solitary retreat. And you think when you're on solitary retreat, well, you're solitary. There's nobody else there. But brothers and sisters, it's not true. They're all there. All your relationships are present with you. Particularly, of course, what's most pressing in your mind is the unresolved ones. But all the positive ones are there. I find Bhante is there with me. All my closest friends are there with me, sort of every day, not literally, as voices talking in my brain or something like that, but their presences in my life. And I remember Bhante speaking very early on in the foundation of the order, saying that he'd gone on a retreat in the New Forest in Britain, in England. And while he was there, he experienced the whole order sitting around him. At that time, the whole order could have formed a single circle around him and not a very wide one. But he experienced us all sitting there around him. Well, actually, all your connections are sitting around you right now. They're all there because anybody you've ever met is a permanent part of you, has modified you, and you've been modified by them. And this is most especially true of those with whom you shared most deeply and shared most deeply that spiritual vision. Again, I remember in my own early days, I'm sorry, I'm reminiscing. You have to forgive me. I'm 74. I'm entitled to reminisce. But I remember the very first retreat I went on. I'm going to shock you and tell you when it was. It was exactly at this time of year in 1970. Yes, I know, dinosaurs still walked the earth. In 1970, I went on my first retreat. And when I went, I had a good social life. I lived in a kind of community, not a Buddhist community at all, but a good one with good friends. And I didn't consider myself to be lonely or out of communication or anything like that. As it happened, I went on this retreat alone. And there I formed friendships, especially with three people, Manjivajra, all of whom are my close friends today. And what I felt when I came back from that retreat was that I'd experienced a different quality of friendship, a different quality of human communication. Not there was anything wrong with my experience before, but there was something new, something deeper in my connection with these people, these very new friends. And it was that we shared that vision of existence, which Bhante set out for us on that retreat. Actually, Bhante was very ill and nearly died on that retreat, but his tape recordings were played to us. In fact, the first evening, he played the tape recording sitting beside it, which rather impressed me. And what particularly impressed me was he laughed at his own jokes. But that vision that Bhante unfurled for us had brought about between us a different level of communication. So those sort of friendships that we make in the context of spiritual community are quite different, and they take us deeper. And so when we go for refuge, we go for refuge with all those people we've ever met. And we go for refuge, especially with those friends who we share that vision of existence with. That's the significance of the prostration practice, which many of you will have done, where all human beings are behind you, your father and mother and your order member friends and mitra friends all around you. That's the significance of that. They literally really are in us. And when we go for refuge, they go with us. And we cannot do it out of that connection with them. And yes, that sort of connection has definitely been the key factor in my spiritual life. I think I've grown from that more than anything. It's given me the context within which to work out my own spiritual evolution. Without that context, it would have been almost impossible for me. I'm quite convinced. Maybe for others it would have been, but for me, it would have been almost impossible. I needed the context within which to reveal myself on higher and higher levels, deeper and deeper dimensions. Without that, it couldn't be done. That's our next task, is to share this context with as many people as possible. So as many people as possible can participate in this wonderful experience of Kalyanamitrata, this wonderful experience of Sangha, because that will enable them to unfold their deeper potential, to realize their highest aspirations. So yes, that's our big task. But there's an issue here, a big issue here, that I want to focus on today. The great danger is that even in forming Sangha, we simply form Sangha with people like us. We find ourselves just drawn to and drawing to us people of the same background, same inclinations, same culture, and so forth. So this afflicts, I think, probably all organizations and probably particularly all religious organizations. They tend to end up being sort of monocultural. And you just end up with a kind of cozy peer group. It's not bad. Cozy is not bad. It's better than uncozy. It's better that it's a pleasant environment than that it's an unpleasant one. But it's not really good enough. It's not going to help us grow beyond a certain point, because all it's going to do is reinforce our own conditioning. It's going to refine that conditioning, maybe, but we're not really going to be deeply challenged as to who we think we are. We need deeper challenge to our self-view so that we begin to transcend that self-view more and more. I'm very aware of this in my time in the movement in Britain. I actually don't function much in Britain anymore, and I haven't done for some years, but certainly in the years when I was teaching a lot in Britain and a chair of a centre and so on, I didn't notice at the time, but in retrospect, I noticed we simply attracted white, middle-class, educated people, almost exclusively, not entirely, but mainly. We attracted people like us, inevitably, because we spoke that language and they could sort of understand us and we could then relate to them. Fortunately, I don't think it's quite as simple as that, but I think there is a very strong tendency even today for that to be true, that we tend to select people like us. I see it in India. In India, we tend to attract people only from one or two Indian communities. Communities means castes. We don't reach beyond those boundaries. It's very difficult. It's much more difficult to do that than to reach beyond class boundaries in Britain, difficult enough as that is. But still, we tend to attract usually the more urban elite of the Dalits. I don't know what it's like in Mexico. I don't know what it's like in France. I don't know what it's like elsewhere. But I think it's worth having a think. Who do we attract in America? Who do we attract in the United States of America? Who do we attract? Is it mainly Democrat voters, etc.? Do we attract across the spectrum? Do we attract across the racial spectrums? Do we attract across the class spectrums, the educational ones, and so on? It's natural that it tends to be a little bit restrictive. It's quite obvious because it's easiest and it happens most simply. You don't have to make much effort. It's interesting when you look at the makeup of the very early Sangha, it was substantially made up of people from the Buddha's own background and family. They're often the same caste as him, and a lot of his own family members were in the community. That's natural. Those are the people who you've got most direct access to. But it didn't remain like that. And if you look at the kind of caste analysis of the Buddhist Sangha, I've not done it in systematic form. It would be worth doing. It's the whole spread across the four varanas, the four colors, so-called, of caste. So there should be a natural tendency to expand beyond a single pool of people. And my own view is that every center should do a sort of demographic survey and just look at why it's limited, if it is limited, and what it is that can take it beyond that that pool. That task of going beyond the immediate easy pool for us takes work, takes a lot of work. It's especially difficult, and I speak personally, when you belong to what you might call the dominant social, economic, or cultural section of society. What you take that as normative, you don't realize that is only one way to be, which is accidental, as it were, is just a matter of accident of history, as it were, that you belong to that. It's not the right and proper one, as it were, that everybody else should join. When I grew up, pretty much my background was the dominant one. I'm a male, I'm heterosexual, white, English, middle class, of a certain education, a certain culture. Well, when I was born 74 years ago, that was still the ruling class, as it were. You tend then from that perspective to see that as normative, and that others ought to be sort of coming up to that standard, rather than recognizing it's just a particular accident of social history and a particular way in which things have unfolded. And very often, because you come from that dominant section, you don't take responsibility for it. You don't take responsibilities for recognizing it. It's not your personal achievement. It's just an accident. Could have been somehow else. But that's the way you tend to see it, unless you begin to interrogate that. And it's quite difficult to do it, because you're being affirmed all the time in that. All that needs to come to the light for everybody, every one of us, no matter what our background and social conditioning, all needs to come to light, needs to be made conscious. Being part of a sangha that does have a wider range of backgrounds represented gives us an extraordinary opportunity to do that. If we're part of an international, intercultural sangha, we have the possibility of going beyond our conditioning. It doesn't mean ceasing to be from that conditioning. I will always be English. My passport will always be British. I will always be white. I'll always be male, and so on. But I don't have to identify with that in a way of attachment. It's just how it is. I don't have to be ashamed of it. I don't have to look down on it, talk it down, for whatever that background may have led to in the world. It doesn't mean ceasing to be male, etc. It doesn't mean guilt. It means not clinging to that conditioning without awareness that it is just a conditioning. It's just where you start. It's not what you are and where you finish. I remember this very strongly, since Chandradasa's here, I'll tell this for his benefit, although it was before his day. When I was early ordained, we opened a centre in Glasgow in the 1970s, early 70s. And at that time, it consisted mainly of young working class, mainly men, but men and women, many with a radical leftist background. So for them, I was the class enemy. I just had to open my mouth and they could tell what class I came from. But worse than that, or more than that, many of them had a rather Scottish nationalist approach, which I certainly don't begrudge them. And for them, I was also the national enemy. It was a big shock for me. I think it was quite a big shock for them as well. They're quite tough at times, quite difficult conversations. They were very Glaswegian and I was very Southern English middle class. We had to break through that into communication. I think that's one of the most important lessons I learned, to let go of my own conditioning, without denying it or feeling guilty about it. Because of membership of a common sangha, we were able to transcend that. I had a very similar experience in India. I had to confront in India how emotionally buttoned up I was. That's part of the particular English conditioning that I have. I see some of the Latin people laughing. You know how buttoned up we are, particularly from my sort of background. We don't easily show emotion. And that's sort of baffling to Indians who wear their hearts on their sleeves. And they came from such a different background to mine, you know, from the worst deprived elements of Indian society, where I came from a relatively privileged background. I had to get across that barrier. And in doing so, I had to face my own inhibitions, my own limitations. And I feel that I owe them the greatest debt of gratitude, that being part of an international sangha in deep connection with so many friends in India has been one of the main growing points for me. I've become a fuller man as a result of that. I've become looser to my own self as a result of that. Yes, ours is an international sangha, but it's more than just an international sangha. It's potentially crosses all the barriers that divide us in the world. And my goodness, are the barriers in the world. You look at them, so many of them. You see, you know, one of the analyses I've been reading of the situation in Ukraine, been trying to find out what's happening to the few Roma people there. They're trying to get out quickly because they do better with Ukrainians than they do with Russians. Then, of course, many Jewish people are getting out. And then, of course, there's Russian-speaking Ukrainians. Oh, and so on. All those divisions that are always present in every situation suddenly come to the surface. So, yes, there are boundaries everywhere, and our sangha must cross all those boundaries. It must cross them, otherwise we sit on this side of the boundary. In order to go beyond that boundary, we've got to go above the boundary, as it were, without denying who we are, but we have to meet, as it were, above those boundaries. This is one of the most powerful challenges that faces us in the Sangha today, crossing the boundaries within a particular nation. It's easier with another country, with another nation, because you know you're different. You accept, you know, we may have stereotypes, you know, all French eat frog's legs and so on. We have these stereotypes of each other. But we know that we're different. So we have to go beyond. It's more difficult within a particular nation because there's so many boundaries there and they need to be crossed. We need to go beyond them if we are to be a true sangha. And if we are not simply to sit within the happy, comfortable zone of our own self-identity. Yes, the rewards for taking us beyond caste, class, race, economic status, culture, etc., are huge. They're personally very great because you're happier and freer when you wear your conditioning more lightly. It's there, but it's not who you are in a larger sense, in a more ultimate sense. And it's important because we're helping to create a genuine sangha that can be an example, an ideal of what humanity can be. Humanity needs to see sangha as one of the most important functions of sangha, is an example. I know it's not an example of perfection. Believe me, I've been in the sangha for nearly 50 years. It is not an example of perfection, but it's an example of trying. We're trying hard and we do succeed. And we do manage to transcend ourselves and meet above without losing our separate identities, as it were. So if we can create that sort of sangha, it's our contribution to conflict in the world. We can show it doesn't have to be like that. We can show that we can meet from all these different conflicting backgrounds as friends, as deep spiritual friends, with a shared vision of humanity that goes beyond any sectional interest. Personally, I've done my best to serve that vision and to try to create that kind of sangha for the last 55 years since I first came in contact with the movement and responded so strongly to it the very first time I came across it, even though I didn't know what it was. Of course, I've done it imperfectly and I've been very unskillful at times, but I've kept going. Whoops. We're picking up. I've done my best and I've kept going like many of my other friends, and we've met somewhere beyond even our own past unskillfulness. But I have to say, it's the most rewarding element of my life, this work within a sangha for the sake of the highest vision. My 75th year, I've been thinking inevitably more and more about death. Who knows how long I've got? If it's statistical, I've probably got another 10 or 12 years, but it isn't statistical. And so it can happen at any time, but I'm more vividly aware of it than I've ever been. Don't fear it. I'm not even particularly troubled by it. I don't feel I'll lose anything when I die. I won't lose anything that is really important to me. Of course, I'll lose, you know, a lot of things I love. But what is most deeply important to me, I'm confident I will not lose. I know that all my spiritual friendships are part of me. They're part of the mind stream that we Buddhists believe will go beyond death and eventually be the basis for a new life. I believe that all those connections will be there with me. They're all in that mind stream, that flowing on of mental events. We have all these friends, we've shared through Tri Ratna a vision of truth in a context of Kalyanamitrata. We've worked together in the order and movement on that basis. Worked together, struggled together, fought together, sometimes slept together. We've done it all. We've come through an enormous amount. I know that does not stop with death. I feel deeply convinced that the work will go on and I will be part of it. It will go on, of course, in all of you, brothers and sisters. You'll carry on and you will bring new generations in to carry it on. But I will be back. That was a note I could have ended on, but I'm not going to. I'm sure that something will follow on from me, and that whatever it is will continue with this same vision, this same work, of building a sangha on the basis of a vision of truth in the spirit of Kalyanamitrata. I'm convinced that that work will go on and that I will go on playing my part in it somehow, sometime, somewhere. Yes, this work is the work of many, many generations. And I hope that you and I, brothers and sisters, will meet again lifetime after lifetime, and that we will work together to bring about this wonderful vision of Sangha, which has as its ultimate ideal the Arya Sangha, which is the ideal human community. I think that's some of the way we can see the Arya Sangha, the Sangha as refuge. It's the ideal of human society. It's what human society can be when we finally let go of our self-attachment. And I'm convinced, brothers and sisters, that we will all go on working together lifetime by lifetime towards that wondrous and elusive goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Subhuti. Thank you very much for that, well, profound and, I would say, deeply encouraging talk. I'm especially left with this notion of our experience right now being an intersection of every person we've ever known, we've ever met. And so in that sense, completely beyond space, even if we're alone, but also what you brought in at the end of that, those connections, these friendships that we share persisting through time. And that's the radical, well, I say radical, it's certainly in terms of our culture's views, radical notion of, in a way, the endless round of rebirth that we often don't talk about very much here in Tiruvannur. I'm really glad to hear you raise that, and in a very positive sense of, yeah, our friendships can last beyond this life. And this, in a way, this community, this movement that we're building, of course, will last well beyond our life. And that's what we're contributing to, and what we, in a sense, we can come back to. Even saying that, that feels a bit risky. We just don't talk in these terms very much, do we? Anyway, so thank you very much, Subhuti, for your talk. Really, on behalf of everyone here, thank you very much. And I'd now like to invite all of you to put any questions in the chat box that you have, and I will present them to Subhuti. Well, 21 messages. Okay, let's see what I can find here. Oh, here we go. So we've got a question here. If you're ready, Subhuti, for questions.
Yep.
Got a question here. First one I see, which comes from Virya Bodhi. In Sweden. Even when we do our best, conflicts arise, and sometimes I have experienced that the other party doesn't want to deal with it. And I think what he's saying, instead wants to leave or withdraw. How do we work with that?
I don't know, the sun has suddenly gone down, and anyway, you can just about see me, I think.
Yes, we
can see. Well, of course, you can't force somebody else to change. But what I've experienced very strongly at times is that when I've done the work on my part, things often change on the other person's part. This can be quite extraordinary with metta, in the metta bhavana. When you've got a long, an abiding enmity, and you do metta for that person, and you do manage to actually get beyond your dislike, even hatred, and you arouse some maitri, some metta. And next time you meet them, you find they're very different. Now, how is that? Because your perspective has changed? Probably partly. Is it because something at another level is taking place? Probably partly. As you probably gathered, I'm a strong believer in these sort of psychic connections, and that when we work on our relationships with other people, we're not just working on the verbal level and on the level of our actual interaction. We're working much more on the level of the interaction of, I can only put it, energy to energy. So I think you just have to continue working in that way. Of course, I can't say much more than that, because one has to go into specifics. Maybe for Virya Bodhi, you'll forgive me for not saying more than that. But yes, I think the main thing is to work on your own attitude to the other person. And that may mean inquiring quite deeply into yourself and what is it that has led you to conflict.
Thank you. So I'm just reading the questions that are coming up. So Ratnasagar from Manchester is asking, we have so much diversity in the order, especially in India, the Western world, and now Mexico. If we do not understand each other, how can we have harmony and unity in the order? Not sure if I do you understand? I'm not sure if I quite understand the question fully.
Well, there are different ways of interpreting the question, so I'm not completely sure. There seem to be two parts. It seems to be a statement that we have a diversity, and that we need to understand each other. I take it what's meant is that often I've noticed this, you know, functioning both in Britain and in India, that there's quite a bit of naivety both ways. People in the West don't really understand India. People in India don't really understand the West, and quite a bit of illusion. And I think it's very, very important that more people from India spend time in the West, not just in Britain, and that more people from the West, to call it that, to use that portmanteau term, spend time in India. It's above all by more and more connections between us across the boundaries that we overcome them. Abante emphasized this very strongly indeed, that there should be quite a bit of mixing up, that people from different centers should swap over. We shouldn't always just be in one center, and that people from different cultures should spend time in each other's situation. And of course, spending time in another culture is a very strong personal growth experience. So yes, I think we need to put conscious effort into mutual understanding, which can't, like, by definition, be everybody doing all of this, but by at least some key people doing it. And I think, for instance, I know that at Adishtana, later in the year, there's going to be what they call a leadership course, in which I think four people from India, at least two, maybe four people from India, people from, I think, Mexico, from New Zealand, I don't know, from a number of different countries will be coming together, sort of not so much senior order members, but the next generation of leadership coming together to work together for 3 months and try to understand things. So we need to put more into this sort of cultural exchange. For instance, I think there should be an Indian always resident at Adishtana. And ideally, somebody from every culture should be there. We've got a little bit of diversity in Adishtana, but there should be even more. So at least a Mexican there and Australian. But yes, I think that we have to consciously work at mutual understanding, because it looks different. Three Australians. I'm very sorry, Kema Bandhu, I forgot you're an Australian. Three Australians at Adishtana. But yes, it's something that we need to consciously work at. The situation is so different in India. Indians, by and large, come into the movement because of the social conditions, the caste system and its legacy. People in the West come in mainly, certainly in my experience in Britain, at least white people of my background, mainly come in out of a sort of personal angst. So there's quite a bit of understanding to be done, which is a job of work.
Okay, thank you. There's quite a few questions coming in. Simon is asking, please could Subhuti say more about freeing ourselves from the labels that we use to define us, middle class, etc., when to do so seems to go against our instinctive need for group membership. In fact, earlier, just to make a reference, Maitra Bandhu in the Q&A was talking about us needing a tribe. I don't know if Simon is referencing that. Simon asks, any practical tips?
Yes, it's certainly true that we need to be we need to recognize our own conditioning. It's certainly true that we need to have a sense of a family that we belong to. And that's very, very important as we move into the Sangha, that we do sense in the Sangha the social context that we require, as it were, as human beings. I think that it is a very deep instinct in us to be accepted. Of course we do, because we're pack animals and we can't survive alone. So we need that very deeply. But we try to transmute that onto the level of spiritual community. We try to move from group affiliation to spiritual community. Of course, we're always amphibious. We're always amphibious. We're partly in the group, and we're partly in the spiritual community. And sometimes the spiritual community is not the spiritual community, it's a group. Frankly, I'll tell you, order members, shut your ears. The order is sometimes, or particular sections of the order, operate like a group. Whoops, I've let the cat out of the bag. But our effort is always to try to go beyond our group identity into a spiritual community. But to begin with, we need in our movement, presumably this is what Maitreya Bandhu was alluding to offer the opportunity for what Bante called the positive group. That is a group identity that is based around the ideals of the spiritual community. I think that this is a subject that deserves a greater exploration than I can give it now.
Okay. I'm sorry if I'm missing people's questions. There's so many of them coming in. There's one here from Pam saying, what was the moment or realization that led to your recognition for the need to us to review who is attracted to our Sangha?
Well, I think I've always been somewhat conscious of it, partly, as always, because of the inspiration of Bante, because he was very concerned about the class makeup of the order. And he was delighted when we set up the center in Bethnal Green, because at that time, Bethnal Green was the heartland of the old East End, the Cockney heartland, working class Londoners. Of course, as soon as we arrived, they left. Not our fault at all. But he hoped that that as a result of being there, we would attract, you know, people from a more working class background. You know, we'd all been looking in Hampstead for a centre. We couldn't find Hampstead, of course, for those of you who are not Londoners, is a very middle class area. But we found the best place possible in the East End of London, in the heart of the old working class London, a classic Cockney London. And Bante was delighted. After all, where did he come from? Working class tooting. He was a working class lad himself. So he's very aware of this. And actually, he used to give us middle class youth quite a hard time, teasing us about our class. But I think that did make me very aware of it. And of course, more recently, through friendships, I've become much more aware of the issue of race. I must mention my dear friend Jana, to whom I'm Kalyana Mitra, who educated me very much on what it was like to be black coming into the LBC. There are various awakenings, aren't there? Points at which you realize that something you take for granted is not a fact, if you see what I mean. You have to take for granted that not everybody has the same privilege of education as you've got. Stop taking for granted that they've got the same economic opportunities and so on. You have to gradually, the boundaries expand or fall, whichever way you like to metaphoricalize it. So yes, I think that I've been educated by Bante in the general perspective. And I've been arguing for some time that our centers should do a sort of demographic survey. And I'm not saying that the centers should always exactly represent, the general population, because it's always something that's going to be worked towards. It's an unachievable but important goal. But nonetheless, we should be able to say, well, London consists of, for instance, this range of socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds. Why is it we only get this range? How do we expand beyond that? So I think it should be a question that every centre's council should be asking themselves, not in an aggressive and undermining and critical way. You know, it, as I say, it's quite natural to start with the people who are most like you. but you need to be conscious of the words you use. You need to be conscious of the images you give, the examples you give, the assumptions that are buried in what you say. You need to slowly become aware of them and aware of how they sound to people from different backgrounds. Well, that's a job of work, as I say. So I think it should be something constantly under review.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to bring a couple of questions together that are around internationality. One is from Nancy. She's asking, how do you reconcile the beautiful vision of an international order in light of the climate crisis indicating the need to eliminate air travel? Mm. And I'll bring that together with one from Akash Nandi, who says, well, actually, maybe that starts to suggest what I think one wants to might be. But she says, do you think it may be easier to cross cultural boundaries virtually and to broaden our Sangha makeup using Zoom, etc. formats? Maybe they don't relate as close as I think they do. But
well,
anyway,
they can connect. Yeah. Well, I think that clearly during this pandemic, when we've all suddenly been Zoomized, we've learned how much we can meet virtually, and well, an occasion like this, you know, I've only got on my screen Hindi, Spanish, and French, and Glaswegian, and English, of course. But we're you know, that's not been very common for us before. So even on an occasion like this, we are able to bring together people from many different cultures, which is a wonderful thing. But I have to say, I think there's no substitute for direct personal contact. So I would say we should minimize our travel as much as possible. Maybe we should even think about walking or at least going by boat or something like that. But I think that it is important that there is immediate face-to-face contact. I suspect that's going to get more and more difficult. And as the questioner implies, I think that's not a bad thing. But we should not let the difficulty isolate us from each other, because we all lose. And I think it's important that we find other ways of meeting. There are other ways of traveling. When that becomes impossible. Yes, I think that somebody's suggesting Sangha to Sangha yatras, pilgrimages, a very, very good idea. In fact, Bhante thought there should be wandering order members without portfolio, as it were, who just move from centre to centre, just spend some time in one centre, move on to another centre, cross the channel, go to another centre there, and so on. He thought there should be a number of us wandering in this sort of way, and that would help to bind the movement together. Bhante thought about all these things quite a lot. He didn't foresee Zoom, of course.
Okay. Thank you. We've got a question from Sudipta, who I believe is, or he's an Indian order member. He says, Dr. Ambedkar has mentioned that if you want to break the caste, class, and religion condition, then get married with somebody from a different caste, class, or religion, religious background. What do you suggest for our inclusive Sangha?
I'm tempted to say no comment. People tend to marry where they marry, don't they? It's interesting that still in our Sangha in India, most people marry within their own caste. I think that is something that needs addressing. And it's even been difficult for people involved with our movement from different communities to find Buddhists to marry their daughters. So marriage is a very big factor in caste. I'm sure it is in other areas of life as well. I can't say I've thought about this very much, but I no doubt there's something more to be said there.
Okay. Yes, there's another area around diversity that a few people are bringing up in the chat, which is around saying, Kara, for example, is saying inclusivity is not just race and gender. Disabled people, carers, and parents. And one or two others have mentioned how can we what can we do more to help disabled people? You know, for example, should we have disability audits at our centres? Miles is asking. Have you got any comments on that? These other areas of diversity, Sabuti?
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't give an exhaustive list. But clearly, that those ones already mentioned are included in the kind of barriers that need crossing. I hope that every centre is wheelchair friendly, if you see what I mean. I know that the LBC, they put quite a lot of money into getting access to the basement, and the Aristana too. So I hope that every centre is thinking about this, and that where they can, they're doing what needs to be done. It's one of the good things about Britain that public centres have to have disablement access. But our centres certainly should, and we should think about it. Like there was an incident recently that somebody wanted to sign up who was height challenged on a rota, but the rota was too high. And something you just wouldn't think about. It would never occur to me to think about that. But we have to actually actively take that into account. And well, I'm told that there's something on the chat box saying that disabled people are actively discouraged from coming on retreats if they can't sign up for a work rota. Well, I really hope that's not the case. It's shameful if it is. There may be other factors, I don't know, but surely every effort should be made to make things easy for people. If the facilities are not adequate, then efforts should be made to make them adequate. Again, I know that at Aristana they have three dedicated disabled facilities, and they want to have more because they see how much that's appreciated. So yes, it's always, you're never going to get it completely right. One thing that I think one has to recognize, you're never going to get it completely right. You're always going to unintentionally exclude somebody, but you have to quickly notice and be very ready to accept when people question you. And I've noticed sometimes when questions are raised, there's a defensiveness. And that's very unfortunate because the defensiveness stops us from learning. Of course, we're going to make mistakes. You can't automatically see everybody's point of view. You have to learn all the different points of view. And there should be open space to discuss these things. Sometimes it's over-ideologized or militant or whatever. Patience. And recognize it's so frustrating if you've been excluded and not taken into account again and again and again. You just build up a great store of frustration, which is going to come out when you start to ask for those facilities. So on the part of, as it were, us, we need to be patient and understanding and recognize where that frustration comes from.
Well, there's actually a question there that possibly gives me a bit of a segue into what I'd like to talk about as we finish this session. We're coming towards the end, which is from Miles asking whether Future Dharma would consider funding for things like disabled access in Buddhist centres. And of course, the answer is yes. Of course, we'll consider that. Speaking on behalf of Future Dharma Fund, we very much want, in the same spirit, to make sure as many people as possible can reach the Dharma. And generally, just to comment personally, this whole topic you've introduced to us, Sabuti, of really looking at our conditioning. I remember Parami challenged me on that once at Adistan. She said, "I don't think you realize quite how subject you are to your conditioning." And of course, I just reacted to that. But now, 2 or 3 years later, I'm sort of wondering if she might have had a point, being another sort of one of those rather fortunate born people. Okay, so unless there's any, I think as we're coming to time, I think I might just, unless there's any final questions, I might just start to speak a little bit just to round the session off, if that's okay. Yeah, I'm getting the thumbs up there. Okay, so just as we finish, I mean, thank you very much, Sabuti, for throwing yourself into that big unknown zone of being able to be asked anything about anything. Thank you very much for your answers. What we're going to do now is watch, if you'll bear with us, we're going to watch a 3-minute video, which until this morning had never been seen. Liz, who's on the call, made it. And I'd just like you to watch this video for 3 minutes, and then I'll say a few words to finish off the session.
A consideration of current world problems makes it clear to us that we have before us today only two alternatives. On the one hand, there's what we call evolution, the higher evolution, spiritual development, becoming an individual. That's one alternative. And the other alternative is extinction. It really means that we, the human race, that is to say, individual members of the human race, must develop spiritually, or sooner or later just perish. So in a situation, not as a predicament like this, what should one do? One should develop oneself. So what does this mean? Self-development means essentially the development of consciousness, or if you like, of the mind. Because it's in this that human development consists. This is the only true human development. Not anything material, not anything external. And secondly, one should join a spiritual community. We know, I'm sure, that it's very difficult to develop spiritually entirely on one's own.
As lightning is seen brightly for an instant in the darkness of a clouded night, so perhaps, for once, the thought of the world may be turned by the gesture of the Buddha to good things for an instant. Indeed, goodness is weak. But the power of evil is always great and very dreadful. By what other goodness could evil be conquered if there were not surely the thought of enlightenment, the Bodhicitta? That future Dhamma Fund is precisely the actualization of the Bodhicitta. It's our attempt to change the world by spreading the Dhamma. That is the manifestation of our Bodhisattva purpose.
Well, we need to raise £1 million, yeah, to get straight, to cut straight to the chase. There are 1,000 arms on the, of course, on Avalokiteshvara, and if 1,000 people can give or raise £1,000, we will raise that £1 million that we need to spread the Dharma over this year and next year. That's what Triyatna needs, and in all projects you've been hearing about today and many more, you know, whether it's ordination training in India, publishing Dharma books, translating Dharma books, coordinating our international movement, funding platforms like this, the Buddhist Center Online, who are putting on today's event for us. All of that we need £1 million for. So sounds a lot, but we can give or raise that. You can give a single gift. You can give a monthly gift. £42 a month is £1,000 over 2 years. £21 a month is £1,000 over 4 years. Or you could make a single gift, or indeed you could raise the money by running a gratitude and giving evening in your Mitra study group. It's all scripted. It's easy to do, and it's a really fun evening actually. So the links are in the chat box to either give or to fundraise for this work, for Triyatna internationally. The great news is we haven't started at zero. We've already had 300, what's the number now? £325,000 so far. No, 322 and a half has been raised in advance of this launch today. So a wonderful start, 2,500 given already today. So if you can give in that kind of scale, then please just do it today. Again, I'm reminded of this phrase from Mike Trabandy's talk this morning, where he said, it's not the harm we do that's the problem, it's the good that we don't do. So if you feel moved to give, please do give. Of course, it can be less than that. Just give whatever you can, as we say. But do act if you feel that generous impulse. I would encourage you. Yeah, I think that's all I'll say. Again, if you want to catch up on any of the events they're now on the Buddhist Center online page that happened earlier today. The next event will be a puja, an international puja from Adisthana. I think from the Adisthana Shrine Room with real life people in the Shrine Room. There are three events going on at Adisthana right now, but also us all around the world by Zoom. And that'll be the final event of the day. And that is at 7:30 UK time. So that's about 2 hours from now, wherever you are. I think that's right. And I just want to say thank you again to you, Subhuti, for your wonderful talk about a vision of existence and an international community. Really grateful to you and for giving this time also to answer our questions. And thank you to all of you for coming. And we'll hopefully see you in a couple of hours for the puja.